Hi, and welcome to Good Authority. My name is Eric Voeten, and today we are going to talk about the recent rise in the overthrow of governments by militaries on the African continent. To talk about these issues, I am joined by Good Authority's resident Africa specialists, who both recently wrote articles in the Journal of Democracy about the challenges and successes African countries are facing with regard to democratic consolidation. First, I'm happy to welcome Ken Apollo. So Ken's an associate professor at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service. And in addition to writing for Good Authority, Ken also has his own Substack called An Africanist Perspective, where he writes about African politics. Welcome, Ken.
Thank you, Eric. Looking forward to this conversation.
And in addition, we have Kim Yi Dion. And Kim is an associate professor of political science at UC Riverside, and she's the editor-in-chief of Good Authority. And she has her own podcast, which is called Ufahamu Africa, but it's a podcast about life and politics on the continent. Welcome, Kim.
Thanks, Eric, for having us.
So, Ken, we have seen a recent increase in military coups, especially in the western and central parts of Africa and also in the Sahel region. And I've seen all kinds of very dramatic descriptions for this trend, ranging from a coup calamity to a crisis of coups or a coup epidemic. So do you think this signals the beginning of like a continent-wide wave of coups and democratic backsliding in Africa?
Thanks for that question, Eric. The simple answer is no. I don't think there's a serious risk of coup contagion. The coups definitely reflect some erosion of the anti-coup norm at the continental level, in part because the continental entities like the African Union or even the regional entity like the Economic Community of West African States have not been able to intervene to reverse the coups. But overall, the countries that have experienced coups have very sort of idiosyncratic reasons for having experienced said coups. The key driver in much of the Sahel, of course, is a question of insecurity. Many of these countries have been facing insurgencies for a long time, and the fight against the insurgencies has aggrandized their militaries and politicized them in ways that made it possible for them to intervene at critical moments over the last five or so years. Beyond that, the other sort of non-countries that do not have security threats have also experienced coups in, you know, following botched elections in which autocratic incumbents, where they're trying to extend their terms, or obviously rigged elections. And so because of that, I think the coup incidents will be contained in sort of these unique countries that continue to struggle with state weakness and endemic insecurity. And I don't expect there to be spillover into some of the more sort of established electoral systems, whether be they democratic electoral systems or some of the more authoritarian electoral systems in the region.
Thanks, Ken. And Kim, your article in the Journal of Democracy is about one of these more established electoral systems, Malawi. And you're really describing sort of a success story there. Can you explain a little bit what has kept Malawi relatively stable in terms of its democratic consolidation?
Sure. I think there's a lot of different forces that support democratic resilience, even during hard times. And that's why I think Malawi is a really excellent example for us to look to. In particular, I think in the case of Malawi, the two key features that I talk about in the essay are the regular movement of people in the streets protesting against what we call executive aggrandizement, or the incumbent president trying to take more control over power and to centralize his power. And, you know, people taking to the streets, expressing their dissatisfaction. We saw that in Malawi, not just in the most recent attempts at executive aggrandizement in 2020, but actually there's a longer history of that, even going back to the fall of the dictatorship in 1994, right? That street protests have been really important. Also important, and I think paying attention to what's happening in the streets, is the role of high courts in deciding in ways that are unfavorable to the sitting president, right? And the independence of Malawi's judiciary has been really important. Again, not just in this most recent period where there were, you know, challenges to democracy, but But going back, you know, to 1994, when there was a return to multi-party competition, to, you know, second term presidents deciding they wanted to stay longer or, you know, do other things that limited checks on their power, you would see the High Court or Malawi's Constitutional Court stepping in. And while I think Malawi is a great example of this, and we should be paying attention to this landlocked little country in Southern Africa, I don't think they're alone, right? And we can see this, for example, in Senegal, a place that I think a lot of people who study African politics are aware of just how important it is to ordinary citizens to safeguard their democracy by taking to the streets when they're seeing presidents or even legislators trying to centralize power and take away people's voices or remove the levers of accountability that they're supposed to be held to, that there's something really important about that, and especially if it can be buttressed by a strong and independent judiciary.
So both of you are pointing out, I think, that we should not treat Africa as a country, right? There are, in fact, different countries here that all have their own dynamics, but also some shared history, of course, and shared threats and trends. The role to judiciaries in several countries is one example. But I wanted to talk about one specific common threat that Ken identifies in his article, which is sort of the aftermath of the Libyan civil war and the security threats that arose from that. And you identified that as one of the main reasons why we're seeing so many of these military coups, and especially in the Sahel region. Can you explain a bit, Ken?
Yes. So I think the problem with insecurity in the Sahel, which, you know, right now goes right from Mali in the west all the way east into Sudan and bits of Ethiopia, right, is partially linked to Libya's collapse. So the collapse of Libya did two main things. One, because President Gaddafi had among his, as part of his coup-proofing strategy, lots of armed men from the Sahelian states that were part of his sort of paramilitary sort of security architecture. After he's kicked out, many of those people were kicked out of Libya, understandably by Libyan citizens, and then went back to their home countries in the Sahel and became sort of, you know, men for hire for would-be insurgencies. The second problem was the fact that Libya's collapse also created this sort of ideological superhighway linking the Sahel to some of the more extremist groups in the Middle East, all the way east into Pakistan. So Alex Thurston has this excellent book looking at the ideational linkages between groups in West Africa and the Sahel and extremist sort of clerics in Egypt, Arabia more generally, but also in Pakistan. And so those two together, right, and the fact that it became easy to smuggle arms made insurgencies in the Sahel very viable. Now, if you add that to the fact that many of these countries were already weak, right, it meant that whenever they faced insurgencies, right, many of them did not stand a chance. So, you know, the first major coup, which was Mali in 2012, which was the wake-up call that, you know, nobody responded to. The coup came about when insurgents from the north were closing in on the capital, Bamako. And since then, you know, the region has had, you know, one problem after another on this. And then related to the Libya problem was, of course, the role of France. I think it's worth remembering that with the exception of Sudan, right, all the countries that we've been talking about over the last 5 years are Francophone countries from our French colonies. I think France took a very heavy-handed approach in sort of the counterinsurgency operations in the Sahel, an approach that to many in the region, right, made them feel that one, France was taking away their agency in managing their own affairs, especially whenever France stood in the way of negotiating with the insurgents. Because like happens in any conflict, many of these conflicts were localized, people fighting over land, but with globalist ideologies sort of superimposed on them. And so it in some cases, it made sense to have a local discussion with belligerents as a government. France and the US in particular were against this idea of talking to terrorists, right, as a matter of policy. And so, you know, the strategy of just raining fire on them from the skies, right, did not work. And so many of these governments felt like they needed to take back the initiative, which also fueled anti-incumbent sentiments to the extent that incumbents in those countries were seen to be close to the US and France in particular. And so the coups are, you know, a mix of these sort of populist anti-incumbent sentiments, anti-French sentiments, mixed with the fact that the militaries in these countries, as a result of the conflicts caused by the wider instability in the Sahel, become salient political players in their respective countries. And I think that made it possible then for generals or, you know, young officers to step in and say, we're coming in, A, to reestablish sovereignty over the security policy, but also to address the failures of previous regimes. Now, you know, of course, as we would expect, the juntas haven't delivered on the promise, right? Because they too still suffer from the same lack of capacity that the people they ousted were facing.
Yeah. And Ken, you write a little bit about public perceptions as well in your piece. Is your sense that in general, the public was pretty receptive to the idea of military takeovers in those countries? And has that also dissipated as the juntas haven't really delivered what they promised?
So anecdotally, I think there's still belief in the juntas, because I guess I'd always known, like, informally, that there was a very strong sovereigntist anti-French sentiment in the publics of the Sahel. But I must admit that even I was surprised by the strength of the feelings. So I think the anti-French / sovereigntist sort of populism is still very much alive and is keeping these juntas alive and in power, even as they fail on the security front. So I think they still have that going for them, and they'll coast in it for a while. And I think back to Kim's paper to talk about this question of public perceptions, I think, and I often like to teach Malawi because Malawi sort of reflects the crux of the argument that I was trying to make, in the sense that on the one hand, right, publics in Africa are very much against military rule. Publics in Africa are also deeply disappointed by how democracy has been practiced and what it's been able to achieve. And so people will support democracy, people are anti-military rule, but people are also dissatisfied with how democracy, the supply side of democracy, if you will. And then the third sort of rail here, if you will, is the fact that people are also willing to accept military interventions when civilian politics fail. And so in the Sahel, what we saw, right, all the people coming out celebrating coups, was a reflection of this, that fact that people in many African countries, a majority, I should say, in many countries, agree with the idea that it's okay for the military to step in if civilian politics fails. And I think many in the Sahel viewed what was happening as a failure of civilian politics.
Right. And Kim, you're right. You say that in Malawi, some people have those same feelings, but they're kept in check a little bit more, right?
Yeah, but I will say, and Ken and I both point to this new question that Afrobarometer is asking in its survey in wave 9. And that is where, you know, in the past, in all these, you know, previous 9 waves of surveys in Afrobarometer, they would ask ordinary citizens their opinions about how satisfied they are with democracy and whether or not they would accept alternative forms of rule, right? So military rule, single party rule, you know, a personalist, basically they're asking, like, which forms of dictatorship are you open to, you know? And for years, those of us who we know so much about the continent, not just from our own research project there, but really from looking at Afrobarometer data, and for years, there has always been this really strong push for democracy and a lot of demand for democracy and rejection of alternative forms of rule. And then at the same time, you'd see Bor Nossing Bey win a fourth term as president. And you're like, wait a minute, you guys don't even want him to have a third term. So how are you saying this in these surveys, but then, you know, the outcome is different? Like, how is it that you say you want democracy, but when the military rolls in tanks down the capital city's streets, you're out there cheering them on? So it doesn't make sense. And I think this new question the Afrobarometer is asked about, when there's something really bad, is it okay for the military to step in temporarily? And I think what that question is helping all of us who've been using these data over the years understand better is that people appreciate, especially in places where they trust their militaries, they appreciate the opportunity that, you know, there's someone else who can check the power of a bad president. And I think in Malawi, my concern, actually, Malawi is a place that's never had a military coup, right? And in fact, there were opportunities for the military to come into rule. And I think in particular, we saw this in 2012 when President Bingu wa Mutharika died in office. There was you know, a lot of, you know, hidden, you know, they didn't say that he was dead for 2 days. And part of that was because they were trying to maneuver in the background. And that could have led to a temporary military transitional government. I don't know what they would have called it, right? They always have these like long names for such temporary regimes that don't always end up being very temporary. But that could have happened and it didn't. And I think part of that is because, again, like the judiciary was very strong. But a broader issue, and this comes out very clearly at the start of Ken's essay, is that democracy is not delivering, right? People have rights more so now than maybe they did in the 70s. People can vote in elections and have more choices now than they may have had in the 70s and 80s. But some people are finding it even harder to put bread or nsema or ugali on the table, right? Like their economic conditions, their ability to meet their basic needs are so poor that they're disenchanted with what they thought democracy was going to bring. You know, that's a theme that comes up, for example, in Zachariah Montpelli and Adam Branch's book, Africa Uprising, that there are these waves of protest. And the wave that we're in now is one that's largely driven by people's disappointment that democracy didn't deliver more economic prosperity. Now, Ken and I, we emphasize different parts of this. So in his essay, he's pointing out like, look, people are disappointed with democracy because it's not delivering in these ways of, you know, providing better public services, you know, really investing in development in ways that improve people's financial security. And my emphasis is that because they are in precarious economic positions, they really don't have much to lose. So they are going to walk in the streets and they are going to demand more because their backs are against the wall. They don't have another choice. And it's this economic precarity that is what's keeping presidents in Malawi in check. And that's not the outcome I want for Malawians. Like I want people, more people to be meeting more than just their basic needs. But it's interesting that it's having this effect of keeping presidents in line.
And do you think this is driven by dissatisfaction with specific national economic policies, or is it really something more structural, right? So we know that there are a lot of recent challenges that African countries are facing are having to do with inflation due to COVID, the war in Russia, rising interest rates in the U.S., really difficult access to finance. We had a great podcast with Lena Mosley earlier that sort of describes this really well, that for like the last 15, 20 years, African countries actually had access to private markets as well as to China, and they could compete and they could get favorable loans, and that's all gone right now. So you can't finance your way out of this anymore. So is this, are African governments just caught in bad global economic circumstances, or do you think this is driven with dissatisfaction with specific economic policies or corruption in government policies of specific countries?
I think it's both. I think African citizens think it's both, right? You know, a place that I would look to would be Zambia. Here's a place that's, you know, dealing with a lot of issues that are structural in terms of its debt and what that's meant for ordinary Zambians. But also their former president, Edgar Lungu, was making a lot of bad choices policy-wise. And also, you know, he and his party were connected to various allegations of corruption, right? We also see that in South Africa. But even in Malawi, the sitting vice president was brought up on charges that he was, you know, engaged in this bribery and corruption connected to a UK-based Malawian businessman. I think all of that is what people are frustrated with. They're seeing these people in power who could make different choices, and they're not. And I think they don't have a lot of tolerance for it anymore. And, you know, thankfully, there's some media freedom in some of these places where we can learn more about this. But I think the example I'm going to be following most closely is Zambia and, you know, looking to analysis from people like Grief Chawla, who's a political economist who understands the kind of debt situation in Zambia really well and how people are interpreting politicians' usage of structural conditions also for making their own political narratives about what's happening and the extent to which they can control that And people can kind of see past it and say, well, even if the Chinese loans are coming up, or even if, you know, interest rates are like this in the world, your party is also acting in corrupt ways. And you are, you know, engaging in these things that we don't think is right and is actually costing us as well.
Yeah, I completely agree that it's both. And maybe this is just a matter of taste, but I would emphasize more, you know, this structural sort of questions, mostly because I've been paying a lot of attention to demographic shifts in the region. I think for the longest time, African governments were able to get away with misgovernance because people always had, say, agriculture or informality as a safety valve and sort of a social insurance system. But what you're seeing now is higher urbanization, a shrinking share of people depending on agriculture, a rise in dependence on food imports, which then means that populations are ever more exposed to global trends, right? So that when there's a global sort of supply shock or inflationary shock, it's affecting kitchens everywhere in the region. So because people are no longer just eating cassava and millet, they're getting grain from, you know, Ukraine, or, you know, rice from Southeast Asia. And so I think that will put a lot, continue to put a lot of pressure on governments, which is why, you know, I fear that, yes, we may not see coups, right, extending beyond these really weak and insecure countries, but we'll see a lot more populism, right? The South African election right now is a taste of what is to come, right? You're seeing, you know, very extreme xenophobic parties doing pretty well, completely outflanking the EFF that many of us had feared perhaps to be, you know, one of the more radical parties. So there's a lot of populism coming down the line, or just authoritarian electoralism in the mold of Talon in Benin, a leader who styles himself as Mr. Competence and actually kind of delivers. Benin is going to be one of the fastest growing countries in Africa this year, and using that as a basis to consolidate power. So the structural elements mean that, you know, to the extent that democracy is not delivering right now, there's a real risk of populist authoritarianism coming down the line.
Yeah, and maybe it's good to talk a little bit about South Africa, because that's obviously an election that a lot of people are paying attention to right now. So we're right now at the state where we're about 30 years out from the ANC winning the first elections. That's usually about the time that independence movements go, I believe. That's a regularity in our research. And it certainly seems like the ANC is not going to keep a majority. So what's going on there? There's clearly dissatisfaction with economic performance over the last 5 to 10 years or so in South Africa. So you're seeing this more in terms of economic populism, but not necessarily authoritarianism?
Yes. So I don't think there's a real risk of authoritarianism, because South Africa, you know, is has many of the elements that Kim points out in our essay, only stronger, right? The courts are super strong. The civil society is very deep. Private markets actually discipline government behavior in different ways. And so I don't see, you know, authoritarianism really, you know, coming into play, but I expect to see a lot of dissatisfaction in the voting outcome. The ANC is projected to fall below 50% for sure. Most of the polls seem stable on that outcome. The fear that I have perhaps is that since the ANC would likely not want to share power with the main opposition party, they'll have to sort of concede points to the more extremist parties that are running on explicitly xenophobic platforms, and also have some extreme ideas about what needs to be done about structural reforms in South Africa.
Yeah, and the DA includes the remnants of the National Party, right? Or the old National Party.
Yeah, so the DA is right now, you know, appealing to the mostly white South Africans, affluent Black South Africans, and mixed race, quote unquote, colored South Africans. Although, you know, there's also a new colored party that will probably get, you know, a substantial share of the vote. The ANC knows them to be a stronger party and therefore will not want to share power with them. So I think the first preference will be to try and cobble together an alliance with some of the smaller parties that they can buy off easily. Because I think the DA will gum up intra-ANC politics and do to them what, you know, Germany's major parties have seen happen to them after getting into a grand alliance of major parties.
Yeah, I'll just add, I know that the polls are showing that the ANC is not going to get to 50%, but the party is not going out without a fight, right? So we saw, you know, just in recent weeks, there was a court decision that's allowing Jacob Zuma to run, right? So here's a person that, you know, many of us looking from the outside might have seen as like someone who, because of various corruption allegations, has just fully fallen from grace. But he's a kingmaker in South African politics. And Cyril Ramaphosa knows that, you know, in order for the ANC to do well, he's going to need Jacob Zuma helping the party get over the finish line. And I agree with Ken. It seems really unlikely that, you know, were the ANC to not have a majority, that they would form a coalition with the DA. But I also think that just opens up this other question of like, why these elections in South Africa, I think, are going to be some of the most exciting to watch, not just for election day, but is this going to be the first time we're going to have to see a coalition be made? And, you know, who's invited to the party? You know, who's in those conversations, and what kinds of deals are they going to have to make about cabinet appointments to make sure that everyone in the coalition is happy? And what does that mean for policy? And I agree with Ken, you know, especially as a person who studies Malawi, a large migration sender to South Africa, who have been targets of xenophobic violence for over a decade now. You know, I am really concerned about potential coalitions that the ANC would make and what the ramifications will be for many people who may not be citizens of South Africa, but make the country run.
So, Ken, in your piece, you also talk a little bit about the role of regional organizations in Africa in preserving democracy. So you refer to these sort of coup norms, the role of ECOWAS, which is an organization for Western African states, and then, of course, the African Union. And we know it's different for regional organizations to actually matter. We did a previous podcast with Dan Kellerman on how the EU has failed to prevent democratic backsliding in Hungary. So if the EU can't do it, what can organizations like ECOWAS and the African Union sort of effectively do to stop democratic backsliding in some of the countries that have experienced coups?
Yeah, I think ECOWAS was tested in part because, personally, I think ECOWAS's failure was mostly a lack of appreciation of popular sentiment. I think most people within ECOWAS thought that this would be a standard, let's move into the Gambia, get rid of the autocrat who lost an election and doesn't want to concede, a move that was popular among Gambians more broadly, right? I think when it came to the Sahel, which is probably, you know, the problem in Hungary and Poland before they found their way back in the right direction, was that within the countries affected, there was disagreement as to whether the coup was a legitimate political act or not, right? And so ECOWAS failed to manage those internal public opinion differences. So the coups themselves were popular. ECOWAS was trying to install a democratic government that had lost legitimacy because of their failures on the economic front, but also with regard to counterinsurgencies. And that just made it very difficult, so that when ECOWAS threatened to intervene, there was a rally around the flag effect with people openly defying them to try and intervene. So I think this is a lesson on IOs that fail to sort of manage the internal politics of the countries they're trying to intervene in. All countries have domestic politics, and when IOs ignore the domestic politics, they're likely to fail. The second thing is that, of course, ECOWAS just doesn't have capacity, doesn't have the same amounts of leverage. It's really shocking that Nigeria, Africa's largest economy, or third largest based on recent IMF numbers, right, couldn't force three landlocked countries to its north to sort of comply with the anti-coup norm in the region. And I think this speaks to the fact that intra-Africa trade and institutional linkages still remain very weak. And therefore, you know, there's very little leverage, especially when there's domestic disagreement over what is to be done. So ECOWAS is strongest when whatever is agreed on in Abuja is what the majority of people in the affected countries also want. When you have disagreement, then, you know, their leverage kind of collapses because they don't have the coercive capacity to actually enforce the norms that they espouse.
And what about the US? So there's also been a lot of talk about the competition between the US and China and Africa, and perhaps the idea that China cares a little bit less about whether it's dealing with a democratic government or not. Do you see that mattering, or does the US not really have that much leverage to begin with to enforce sort of democracy norms in Africa?
I think the US doesn't have leverage in the sense that the US also doesn't have strong links in the region. Going back to the 90s, I think it was a mistake for the US to go the route of NGOization of its engagement with the continent because it completely severed any sort of official links with government. So embassies in the Sahelian states, some were operating at, less than 30% capacity because appointments were delayed, staff were not showing up to their posts. Relationships with these countries basically were allowed to die. And that limits America's ability to sort of exercise leverage over the governments, or even coordinate with Nigeria and other members of ECOWAS. And I think the US also suffered in this particular instance by being tied to France. Part of the reason why America finds itself getting kicked out of Niger is that it's seen to be too close to France, which has had, pretty interventionist policies in these countries over 60 years that are deeply unpopular. And then on China, I think China doesn't care about the regime type that it's engaging with. But I think more importantly, right, because China, does this in democracies and autocracies alike, China's biggest selling point isn't necessarily that it doesn't, care about the regime type. It's that it delivers on our observables, right? Roads get built, power lines get built, water systems get built, and those things count. So, if you're an autocrat who runs elections on a 5-year cycle, right, you'd rather go with the person that will help you build roads than the person who's running a democracy workshop, right? It makes sense that these countries are opting for the visible, attributable outcomes that voters want. So, in a perverse way, right, democracy promotion is push Zambia, Kenya, Ghana, right, to borrow very heavily from China because people need to see things happening on the ground.
So this has been really fascinating. So I think both of you agree that this recent increase in coups is not really a wave or something that's continent-wide, but it's heavily contingent on the countries that we're in, the kind of strength of domestic institutions that are already existing. So where do you think the most fragile states right now are, where we haven't yet seen coups, but where we might expect them over the next year or so? Or is that really hard to predict? So maybe starting with Kim.
Sure. Yeah, I am never in the business of predicting coups because,
We
the many
don't want to, but I think
things.
it's
Right. No, but I get that there's like a people want to have something to look to. What should we be paying attention to? And I think for me, based on the work that I've done, but also like reading other people's work, including reading Ken's recent essay, my concerns about fragility are less about tanks rolling into the streets of the capital in some given country and more about the rhetoric that candidates are using in elections and the extent to which it's populist rhetoric. Because especially given the economic precarity that a lot of people are facing on the continent. So for me, a bigger concern I have is about the rise of populism and populist rhetoric and populist leaders who then, when they get in to govern, realize it's actually quite hard and they can't just do the redistribution that they promised during the campaign trail. And then they engage in this executive aggrandizement, right, where they try to centralize their power. So I think that that's a threat, like anywhere where a substantial proportion of the population is struggling to meet their basic needs.
Right. And it's not just an African threat, right? This is actually a parallel with Latin America, with Europe, with North America as well, then.
Exactly. I think there's that. I also worry about places that are of geostrategic importance, precisely for the reasons that Ken brings up in his essay, but that he's also brought to light for us today in this conversation. And that is when a place is of geostrategic importance, outside actors don't care about domestic politics and they make decisions that benefit them and that will, I think, be a real threat to long-run democracy. Because when a ruler is getting these rents from outside, they don't have to pay attention to what the people want or need. And I think that's where, we have to think longer term, and we have to consider implications and negative consequences when we make these kinds of interventions. Being of geostrategic importance actually makes you fragile, because the potential for external actors to influence things in ways that divorce you from domestic accountability. And that's where I'm concerned.
Yeah. Well, Eric, I'll take the bait and say that, you know, Chad is probably the one place that I think is top of the list. Chad is slow walking into a coup. So Chad would be top of my list. And then, you know, very sort of latent risk I see in Togo, where the president just switched to a parliamentary system in order to basically stay in power forever as a prime minister. Cote d'Ivoire, depending on how they manage their transition, because Cote d'Ivoire is ripe for being infected by the same sort of sovereigntist populist developments that we've been talking about regarding the Sahel. And then lastly, Uganda, where the president's son is trying to succeed his father. I'm not sure they both of them agree on that outcome, but, you know, he basically forced his father to appoint him as head of the military. So Chad, definitely on my list. Countries that I'd very much worry about, Cote d'Ivoire, Togo, and Uganda. And I absolutely agree with Kim that, you know, the much bigger risk is this threat of autocratization through populism. As Africa gets more urban, economic problems sort of accumulate, and farming ceases to be an outlet for many people, we're going to see a lot more populism in the region.
Right. Well, thanks to you both for a really enlightening conversation. I learned a lot, and I'll keep reading your stuff and listening to your podcast to learn more about Africa. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us, Eric.
Thanks.
Good Authority's mission is to bring insights from political science to a broader audience. Everything we publish, including this podcast episode, is freely available with no paywall or subscription fee. All Good Authority content are under a Creative Commons license and can be copied and redistributed, as long as the work is attributed to us and any changes are noted. We'd like to thank our funders, especially the Carnegie Corporation of New York, the Democracy Fund, and Vanderbilt University. This podcast is hosted by Eric Vooten, director of the Georgetown University Mortara Center for International Studies, with help from Good Authority Editor-in-Chief Kimmy Dion and Multimedia Research Assistant Emily Hahn. You can find links to what we mentioned in this episode on our website, goodauthority.org.